This week on the Glass Cannon Podcast, after the conclusion of book one, the gang recalls some of their favorite moments.
I really enjoyed, as a moment, that time that Bork got launched out of a catapult.
Oh, I forgot.
How can we forget?
Tries to grasp Skid's dated references.
He looked like the lead bassist from Striper.
So weird that I didn't get Skid's reference.
And learns of the sordid history of the Plague House.
Me for a little finger bang sesh at the Plague House.
Plus, a long-awaited backstory may come to light.
But there's one character I think we don't know very much at all about, the most mysterious character of the group. I think it's time, depending if you want to kind of let loose the backstory here a little bit.
The adventure gets deeper now.
Hello out there, Glass Cannonites. Matthew here just to say hi and to spare you the math this time. So, book one. Done. True now. Saved. For now. But yeah, we're pretty pumped. Been an awesome story so far, and in case any of you are worried, we have literally no intention of stopping. We have a special episode coming up today. Don't want to say too much about it, but suffice it to say, nerdage! Yeah, anyway, thanks as always for listening and for all of your support. It's really fantastic. And thanks to those super nerds who are doing yeoman's work, spreading the word. We really appreciate it. Special shout out to my brother-in-law, Logan, who's outed himself as a total fan and convinced people in his office to listen. Well done, Logan. Anyway, sit back, relax, and enjoy episode 29.
Okay, do you guys want to start book two, or do you want to do chores?
Let's dive right into book two. Wait, was that a rhetorical question?
I think Joe wants to do chores.
Let's do chores.
I'd rather do chores.
That makes Joe's bed.
It's character building.
You know, right off the bat, before I forget, I think we've mentioned it probably on Twitter before, but I want to give a huge shout out to Patrick Reaney, who was the head writer of book one.
Yes, thank you, Patrick.
Big round of applause.
What a writer.
Good times.
You know, and
he wasn't
alone. There was like seven other authors and 12 different artists, including a cover artist. I mean,
and we put up a bunch of that artwork on the Tumblr because it was just so good.
Phenomenal. And, you know, we've been looking at Adventure Paths for a while. The artwork for this was unbelievable. They really stepped up their game.
They really did.
This is my favorite.
How about the art on the Skald?
Oh, the Skald.
I keep looking back at that picture and being like, oh, I want to see that guy again. Like, just
I think
up
part of it,
on that tower.
Part of it is the subject matter, but this really is my favorite art from any Adventure Path that I've played.
Yeah. Agreed.
Well, all I can say is it only gets better.
What, have you read ahead?
Oh, yes, I have.
I got to say, though, too, nice little touches like Screed really not looking like you expected.
Right.
The cave troll being kind of just...
Kind of look like Dolph Lundgren.
Those luscious locks.
Right.
Nice. And cool that he was an alchemist.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, when they said facial tattoos, I just pictured this huge, beefy, like, half-orc that was, like, a barbarian in charge of this army.
Mike Tyson.
You know? Right, right. But instead, he was, like, a nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He liked to play with his chemistry set.
He looked like the lead bassist from Striper.
What band? Yeah,
it was like a Christian metal band.
It's so weird that I didn't get Skid's reference.
That never happens. We need another drop for Skid's references. No one else gets.
We do.
Nick,
send us in a drop for Skid's reference.
Or we'll just play a couple of licks from a Striper song.
Sure, we won't get sued.
They're all dead. So, you know, we started to do this at the end of last episode, and I kind of want to continue in that vein. You know, obviously this is a momentous occasion to jump into this new book, but I think we should give pause for a moment and kind of take a step back and do like a, what's the word I'm looking for? A little talk back about how book one went, maybe a little character stuff, a little housekeeping. I think that'd be fun to kind of just take a break and talk about the other stuff, rather than just like, what did I roll? Let me talk to this guy. Let me talk to that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we started to do it last episode, and so I think we should do that for a little bit, and I'll give a little tease into book two later in the episode.
That works for me. And you know, it is a part of the game. Like, when you play this game not recording yourself,
right,
there's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of, like, talking out character stuff. There's a lot of sometimes the DM will take a player, you know, just aside or into another room because they have to talk about something that the other players can't know yet or whatever. And that kind of stuff is really fun. And also going back over battles that you were just in, you know, rehashing like, what if we had done this or did that? If we tried to treat with that guy, would he have still attacked us? You know what I mean? Stuff like that. It's fun to get the DMs behind the scenes.
I like that idea of pulling someone aside. I think we could still pull that off in this podcast. Like, I could just walk into the other room with my wireless mic and bring Matthew in and be like, Gormley is poisoned.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I mean,
three rounds to live. Yeah. She has cancer.
Oh, Jesus.
And the poison is the chemotherapy she's receiving, and she's going to beat it. She's going to beat it.
Roll fortitude save.
What a dark turn that would be. Dark turn.
I mean, there's a zillion things we can talk about. I'm trying to think what a good jumping off point was, but let's talk about, like, what was your favorite? Do you guys have any favorite moment or moments from the first book that you just come to mind off the top of your head, either for your character or for another character?
I honestly, my favorite, re-listening to it especially, was the fight with the cave giant at the Hope Spring, because I just love the facing off against an epically large enemy like that. And it was, you know, especially with the artwork, picturing that thing, it was just so out of above our pay grade.
Right.
At that point.
Yeah. And I mean, we had never seen anything like that. Like the orcs chained to him, swinging whole orcs at you. That was insane. The images were so vivid.
Yeah.
Very God of War.
Yeah. And I've never seen, it was choreographed really well. And I've never seen anything like that. And it was just really fun. That was really, really cool.
That was fun.
I loved the whole murder mystery. Like, you don't get to do that a whole lot. Like, go around interrogating NPCs, looking for lies, doing sense motive checks. And I thought that was really fun. Trying to cleverly, like, actually be detectives. Like, you don't get to do that often in these games. You end up, you know, fighting undead skeletons a lot. You don't get a chance to, like, use your brain in a detective sort of way.
I was going to say exactly the same thing, and I loved when we were like interrogating Cham about the book and what Screed looked like. And I loved walking in there and just flipping the bed over and finding this shit. It like felt very CSI and super fun to do.
Yeah.
And like when we did the alchemical check, like my alchemy skill has been mostly useless, but like to check for the oil of Taggart, that was all really cool.
It's all fun, fun when that works, those random skill checks. What about you, Matthew?
I really enjoyed, as a moment, that time that Bork got launched out of a catapult.
Oh, I forgot. How did we forget?
As a new player watching the look on Joe's face and Skid's face as Troy explained that was actually possible within the rules.
Yeah, I mean, to me, like, that's one of those things where you look at your DM and you're like, you can't do that. Like, okay, you want to do it for flavor and you want to scare me and you want to make it like crazy, like, that's fine, but if it's actually going to kill my character, like, it better be within the goddamn rules. And then you just, like, read the rules, and it was like, and at the end it was just like, and then you die. And I was like, oh my God! Like, scared the shit out of me.
In that moment, it made it very clear to me that the closest Looney Tunes character to Lork is Wile E. Coyote. Because he's older, he always comes back when shit goes wrong, and he's always ready to, like, be there and ready, and things may not always work out, because he's, you know, chopping his face open with an axe, he's in a boulder, but he's such a badass that he always comes back, and it's a lot of fun.
He's always ordering rockets by mail. Mm-hmm.
It would have really been Wile E. Coyote if the catapult just slammed into the rock and squished him.
Cartoons.
The Acme Corporation.
What about you, Troy? When you were reading it and prepping it, like, what was your favorite? Where were you like, this moment is going to be awesome?
Well, and I mentioned on the podcast, the thing that I read that I was so excited about was the choking hazard episode where saved Sarah Morninghawk and Gormley almost died.
Oh, in the house, in the burning house?
I just loved the mechanic because there were so many different things going on, and you guys had to lift the lock, you had to overcome the choking, and then you had to kill these orcs, and then you had to save Sarah, who was unconscious and dying, and stabilize her while the log was on fire, everything. And the house was going to collapse in X amount of rounds. I love when there's a lot of different things going on and you as a team have to navigate, all right, who's going to worry about what? For me, that's fun. I like being a part of that as a player, so yeah. Being able to run that was my favorite.
You said at the time that that was your favorite encounter that you'd ever seen.
Yeah, and I think it played out pretty well.
Yeah.
Gormley almost barely. Went down.
Gormley almost went down, yeah. Were it not for a 19, I think.
Lork carried Baron out of that house. He was unconscious.
That's right.
It was an intense fight.
And we played that one a little differently than we've been playing a lot of the other combats, because we did a little more Theater of the Mind in that one.
Right, that one was off the map. We were wondering early on, should we do maps? Is that going to slow the game down? People can't see the maps. This is obviously a radio play for all intents and purposes. But we've done everything on the map except, you know, the role-playing, the detective stuff, and that one scene, a little behind the scenes of how we do things. And it almost got you killed, so we'll never do it again.
Yeah, yeah, that happened.
I want to talk about this concept of like distinguishing player knowledge and character knowledge. You know, because you guys obviously, having played the game for various amounts of time, some of you more than others, you guys can come up against a creature or a situation, and you know as the player more than your character would actually know. How do you navigate between those two things?
You know, one of the reasons, and Skid, a while back, I remember you did an intro where you discussed a character backstory. And, like, the example that I'll bring up is that exactly. You talked about how you didn't want to not reveal all the cool stuff you would come up with, and if you wait too long, then it just doesn't happen, and you lose that opportunity among your players, you know, and for yourself to have these things, you know, out there, all this cool stuff about you. And while I do think that it is kind of interesting, you know, some of the Lork backstory that I did, I didn't talk to any of the players about. I just talked to Troy about it, and we kind of let it come out over time about his son, and everything was revealed during the blah, blah, blah. But a lot of that, I think, is because, you know, you get concerned that too many players are going to use their knowledge, not their character's knowledge. But if you can be a disciplined player and not cross that line, then I highly recommend that players tell each other their entire backstory, which is something you like to do, I know. Mm-hmm. But you have to make the separation. You know, the perfect example is like you have a rogue in the party and his backstory is like he has spent his entire life in and out of jail for thievery, you know, and then he gets in this group and he tells like this whole story, and then the players like go, you know, and they get some loot and he's like, I'll carry it. And all the players are like, no, let him carry it. He's a career criminal. Yeah. But it's like, no, but your character doesn't know that, you know, like you have to think like with the limited information your character has. Now, does that mean you can't be creative and like coming up with ways for your character to figure it out without it being super obvious? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
this guy seems shady. Yeah.
Can I do a sense motive? Yeah. Roll against each other's characters and sometimes, you know, for skill checks and stuff. But I really do try to do that, but it does take a lot of discipline and you can screw up.
Yeah. And I mean, this talk a little bit about metagaming is that, you know, as it's weird for me as a newer player to like, encountering that, but one of the things I've appreciated watching you guys do is come up against a rule or something in the numbers that and then having to justify it backwards into story, like you do this a lot, Joe. You're like, well, you're like some stupid rule about cover or concealment. You're like, oh well, it makes sense if you think about it like as a human being or half orc anyway in this situation.
he's half human
like, lower half,
he would be you know,
God damn it.
Or like God, I don't even know where I was going now. Or like, I remember whenever we get criticals, a lot of times you guys will find some way to justify it with the story. Like, oh, this is a new weapon. Lork isn't fully, you know, he hasn't used the battle axe in a while. And so you kind of work backwards from the rule.
Right.
That's a cool thing too, I think. I've been thinking about that for like failed skill checks, for example, is they don't necessarily reflect a failure on the player's part. They can reflect a reality in the world. So it's like, if you're like trying to do a linguistics check to decipher an old manuscript or something, and you roll poorly, it doesn't mean that the player's knowledge failed them. It could mean, oh, there's a whole section of this that's been obscured, that's like been smeared, and it's unreadable.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, you know, and another way to think about that is actually, and I'm taking this right from the creator of Burning Wheel, Luke. What's his name?
What's his name? I was just talking about him today.
I'm blanking.
Luke. Burning Wheel Luke.
Yeah, Burning Wheel Luke. I mean, that's his Twitter. So, like, Burning Wheel Luke, he has this thing. And, Troy, like, you should seriously think about this because I try to do it too, but it's tough.
Luke Crane.
Luke Crane. It is that failures should not necessarily mean a null result. It isn't a failed skill roll. You're trying to read the manuscript, but you fail the skill roll. And say, for the purposes of the story, you know, as the DM, it would be great if they could translate this right now because they'd learn some really cool shit.
Right.
Well, you just let them, like, translate it, but then an orc busts through the door.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Like, stuff like that. Or, like, you failed your climb check. You really need to climb that wall or else they can't get that door open. The adventure just stops. So it's like, yeah, you succeed at the climb check, but when you get to the top, like, you twist your wrist and you have a minus one to hit for a day or whatever. You know what I mean?
Like, no, that's very interesting.
Shit like that. And that's how he always does his games. And I thought that was a really smart way to go about it.
Yeah, I like that.
And then I think the only time it has really popped up to where we let our prior knowledge dictate things in a way that our characters might not at level one, which would mean that they don't have a ton of experiences, we all said, oh yeah, burn the troll, ask the troll,
do this to the troll.
So we've fought trolls since they're so kind of stock enemies,
and
we're just like, get them.
Actually, I justified that to myself in that Lork had spent time with the Black Arrows and he absolutely fought trolls. Like, he was a giant hunter. You know what I mean? Up where they all are.
That's probably something in, like, children's storybooks, too, when you were a kid. They were like, if you see a troll, throw fire on him.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's like people know shit from fairy tales right now. It's just like, oh, take a witch, like, put her in an oven. But right. if witches and trolls were actually real, people, it's like, oh, there are actually trolls. Like, you would grow up knowing all of that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
And True Now is very militaristic. It has to be ready for any type of invasion. And the fact that they give people at their bar mitzvahs in this world a knife to kill themselves or their loved ones with in case an orc shows up means that they might know these things.
Or if you need to cut some logs.
I think adventurers in a fantasy setting would have way more basic knowledge than we give them credit for.
It's true.
Because they aren't just plopped into this, like, planet, you know, from, like, our world. Dungeons and Dragons cartoon. Like, they've grown up here. Like,
they all have, like, uncles that died from a troll attack.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, Joe, you mentioned about, revealing character backstory and, you know, whether or not you tell the other players or how much you tell the DM, blah, blah, blah. Let's talk about that for a second. Now, obviously, in episode one, we talked about, we gave a little taste of backstories, and I'm sure there's other elements that you guys haven't revealed to each other, and I'd like to do that. But there's one character I think we don't know very much at all about, the most mysterious character of the group. Miss Gormley, Miss Baron Redheart, Miss Gormley Call, I think it's time. Depending if you want to kind of let loose the backstory here a little bit.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a bunch because, you know, now that we've gotten to the end of the book, I was like, this whole thing started by at this, like, stupid Hope Knife ceremony, and Gormley was in town, which she normally would not be.
Right,
like, she would be off at the mountains with Howie, and yet.
Why was she there?
Well, so I've been thinking about that a lot, and I think what it was is that Gormley has actually slipped into town every now and then to kind of, like, play pranks on the town.
Amuse herself?
like so little so chaos throughout the town.
And she's like the Grinch.
She's like the Grinch. Up there on Mount Crumpet. Yes, but anyway, so.
Well, hold on. I'm going to cut you off just because let's talk for a second about what we know about Gormley. Like, we know that Gormley was born in Trunau, for some reason left, right? Like, or was cast out and is an artifact hunter. Like, that's something that you started talking about a lot during the raiding of the Giant's Tomb just in the last few weeks. So, like, how did you get to be that? And I don't know. That's all I know about Gormley.
Well, she also hinted early on at some kind of personal history with Roderick.
Oh, that's right. But I forgot about that.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's actually... Well,
she's kind of made innuendos to a lot of the males we've met with. So, hold on, let me do my Beth Matthew. It's been a long time.
It's pretty good math.
But there was something specific about Roderick, I believe.
And she would have been much older than Roderick.
She is older than Roderick.
Maybe she was a creepy babysitter.
But I think Roderick kind of had, like, the son of... It was like the, you know, he was Roderick, and he was always the...
Right.
Yeah, the star quarterback of Trunau.
he played quarterback at Trunau High.
those Freedom Town Jerks.
It's the Trunau Knights versus the Freedom Town Jerks.
Trunau Homecoming.
I don't want your life.
The Last Wall Crusaders. So I think it's time to now I want to like name a football team for every area.
The Trunau Hope Springs.
Yes. We need to know what you want to tell us.
Give us something.
So Gormley was born in Trunau. Yeah, she never knew her father. Raised by a single mother. Her father died. You know, in some maybe an orc raid. Something
troll. Probably
troll.
fell down a well.
Yeah. So she was she was in Trunau, and she was kind of this uncontrollable, rambunctious kid, and she was running around and. As she got older, it became a little more problematic. And, when she was a teenager, she started to get really into things like artifacts and stuff. And she met and fell in love with, a prominent son of the town. And the two of them would go off and, maybe to the plague house and sneak off and look at stuff together.
And bang.
I was trying to keep it PG-13, but yeah.
Meet for a little finger bang sesh at the plague house.
I found a new toy.
Oh, so she's an artifact hunter.
Wait, is that why all those hope knives were just laying around that place?
Dark.
That hilt. No, the hilts, not the blade.
Gotcha. You find a string of anal beads that are all pearls of power. All right.
That's not where you're supposed to keep it? Anyway, so the two of them, they got a little more, they got pretty intense together, and Gormley was dipping a little farther into magic, maybe, than he was comfortable with, and obviously she was very young and didn't have a lot of control. And so there was an encounter where they came upon, a crime happening, and, Troy and I have discussed a little bit what this was, but basically there was, a guy in the town taking advantage of a younger girl, and Gormley and her boyfriend were there and, intervened. And
was it Roderick?
It was not Roderick.
Okay.
Gormley is 40, so this would be, Roderick would have been a kid when she left.
Right.
This is when she was, 15.
Gormley has aged really poorly.
Well, the mountains are hard places to
live. Yeah, right. No, I agree.
And when they intervened, Gormley tapped into this power that she didn't know how to control, and things got kind of out of hand, and something tragic happened, we'll say. And when the town found out, the pressure was on the boyfriend to kind of point the finger at Gormley and distance himself. And he did. He betrayed her.
Right, because he belonged to a noble house. He was a nobler house. And
this
she was...
fuck!
And Gormley was very working class. And, definitely, he was slumming a little bit with Gormley. And his family pressured him to betray her. And he did. And the town basically gave Gormley the choice to either, leave or submit herself to justice, and her mother sided with the town. So Gormley had literally no one. And so she left. And so she
Where's
left.
Her mother?
I think she's dead by now.
Okay.
Can I just say that I might not be alone. Some of our listeners might also think this. This sounds a lot like Rogue's early life from X-Men, the animated series. I'm not making a total joke. This is not she.
That's
she
where Matthew got all of this.
She kissed a boy.
Up, so you're she just accusing him of plagiarism?
No, not at all. There's only so many stories. We're all copying Shakespeare after a while. I mean,
he was copying too.
But it was like you were blamed. You had to shoulder the blame for all of this happening.
Sorry for bringing it up.
Doing something. And yes, things got out of hand and out of control, and she did hurt somebody. But then she was stopping a crime from happening.
Yeah, so it was unfair. It was a witch hunt.
She was vilified.
How do you feel about this guy? Oh, go ahead, Skid.
Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's like a crucible.
Yes.
Oh.
And I think to Gormley's credit.
You certainly are stronger now.
Well, yeah, to her credit, I think she was like, fuck all of you. I'm going to go find a way to make my own life, and then ended up in the mountains doing her own thing, and that was very hard and, kind of.
Well, yeah, but then we still have another 15, 20 years unaccounted for, which
we can fill in as we go.
Fill in as we go, but yeah.
Yeah, but I wanted to know the incident that got her cast out, and I did not know. I kind of thought that Troy was putting you on the spot there and that you didn't actually know.
Without
you just sort of like made it.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't at all.
You really, that's awesome.
No. It's all improv. Matthew, to this day, what do you think Gormley feels about this guy? Because he must still be around True Now, unless he's dead. I mean, if he's your age.
I mean, I think, as we saw a little bit when Gormley encountered the girl who had been, you know, the girl and her mother who were almost very nearly raped by orcs, that, like, she feels very strongly about getting even. And I think, yeah, to Grant's point, I mean, rage is certainly a part of it. It's like just this complete and utter betrayal by the entire, everybody she knew, literally everybody she knew.
Yet nobody sided with her.
Nobody. And because they were all freaked out by like what she had done.
I wonder how it crosses over with Lork, because we're the two older characters. So I wonder if Lork was there at that time or if he was already gone at that time.
You were probably with the Black Arrows.
Serving in the Black Arrows.
Yeah, I probably was. I would.
Yeah, that would that the timelines would line up.
Well, no, we're of a similar age. I don't. Well, you know what? He probably would have been sent out.
You were
there.
A teenager when you got cast
that's
out.
True, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I would have been 14 or 15.
It would have been really funny if Lork really liked Gormley when she was, you know, relatively normal and, like, she cast him aside and then said no to his advances and now they're fighting shoulder by shoulder as much different people. That'd be great.
She was hoping that Lork would ask her to prom.
the other answer to your question is that, I mean, this moment when she became part of this party, this community, the only ever other person she'd ever gotten that close to before was this guy. Like, that he was the only one she ever shared that interest in magic and artifacts with.
As she was blossoming into a woman.
That sounded so terrible.
Well, now you can understand why she's so weird, I think, a little bit, and pissed, you know, to have your whole, like, imagine everyone in your town turning against you, including your own mother, and casting you out.
She's like Ally Sheedy in Breakfast Club.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why she's just running around, cackling around the battlefield. She has to laugh, or she'll cry.
You gotta laugh,
or she'll cry,
or she'll weep. One of you mentioned before about geography. I think it was Grant, and we've had some fans write in asking more about the geography, because if you don't play Pathfinder and if you're not familiar with the world of Galarian, this might be interesting for all of 3 minutes, which is all I'm going to give you, Joe, to talk about the geography before our subscribership plummets. But no, I think it's important, especially now where there's this element that maybe these four heroes will be leaving the walls of True Now. And what does this world look like?
Yeah, I think that it's important to me because it is, I always go into games like this and I go into, like, you know, when I've dabbled in, like, you know, writing stuff, I wrote my fantasy short story or whatever, like one of the first things I do is, like, I need a map. Like, I need to see it. I need to see where things are happening. You know, I mean, how many fantasy novels out there do you, like, pick up at the bookstore and you open it up and if there's a map in the front, you're like, all right, I'm in.
So,
like, this guy gets it, you know, like, and so, yeah, so just to give a really brief overview of kind of, you know, what the world looks like, not the whole world, but, like, kind of where we're at. Think of it like Europe. It's very simply Europe. That's really what it is. And there's a giant place called the Inner Sea region, and that's, like, the Mediterranean Sea. And we're north of that in what is, like, Europe. And you keep going up as if you went up from, like, France, right? Straight up through. But if there wasn't the Baltic Sea up there and it was all land, you know, that's kind of where we are. It's up around where, like, Norway might be if there was just all water and it wasn't too, too cold yet. Mm-hmm. That's where we're at. So we're, like, straight up off of there. And if you go straight south from True Now, it is kind of Frenchish, Italianish. There's a lot of, like, warm climate-y, very civilized, extremely, like, advanced cities with, you know, like, lots of trading and you know, seaside port cities,
various,
like,
cheeses,
like, right? Exactly, like, you know, you
are that all we are to you, Troy.
lots of art and all that kind of shit. But up here, it reminds me a little bit of, like, old Germania, you know, kind of thing, where it's like wild and there's a lot of
Visigoths.
You know, they're orcs, but yeah, they're basically, like, you know, an allegory for Visigoths and that kind of thing, where, like, those were the places you didn't go. Like, if you were in Rome, it was like you didn't just, like, travel up to Germania. And that's sort of the way I think about Belkson. You know, it's like, yeah, it's an allegory for that kind of thing. So where we are in True Now and this idea of going to the Mindspin Mountains – They are to the southwest of Trunau. Trunau represents the southernmost point of all of Belkson, where all these orcs are. So if we keep going up north toward the North Pole, we're going to run into a whole bunch of orc bands and orc tribes. But I think that, and we're tucked right into these Mindspin Mountains. So I think we might be moving out a little bit southwest.
We're right in the foothills.
Yeah, right in the foothills of these mountains. And this mountain range is huge. It goes it's southwest from us, but then it curves up to the northwest. It curves, and then it goes far down south as well and kind of splits into those lower, warmer climate countries that I was telling you about. And it is, if you read up on it, the Mindspin Mountains are like extremely dangerous, just populated with giants and trolls and orc tribes, and it's a violent, nasty place, and Lork has been there. You know, when I think about them, I think about Lork after his injury being released from the Black Arrows with this child that he basically had to, like, carry, and he had to, like, hike on foot through the Mindspin Mountains to get back to Trunau from where he was. And honestly, like, story-wise, I don't even know how he did it. Like, I'm amazed at him as a character because I can't figure out how he did it without dying, because it's a brutal area, and that's where we're heading.
I like this idea that Lork used to be maybe 12th or 13th level, and then over time he sort of went back down to first level and now is regaining all his knowledge in the field. That's cool. And Grant, just very briefly, talk about this Sky Citadel thing that you're interested in the Mind Spins.
One quick thing to talk about and touch on that Joe brought up is that even if we run into giants, the Mind Spin Mountains, as massive as there are home to a wide variety of giants, from fire giants to hill giants to this kind of giant. So we could come on a relatively advanced civilization. At some point, it's possible that might deal with us or at least tolerate us, and that could lead to something cool. But at the northeasternmost range of the Mindspin Mountains is where the capital of Belkson is. It's called Urgir, which means first home. It was actually founded by Belkson the Orc, who was trying to reclaim lands from the dwarves and civilized people that had taken it from them. At that point, and he actually took over one of the 10 sky citadels, which are incredible structures with which the dwarves first started their civilization on the surface of the earth after leaving the core. And so that's huge. And it has been so long since that happened that the only people who would even think that this was previously a dwarvish place are orcs that live there, because it's still cluttered with dwarven runes and their religiosity and their history carved into the very rock, but also dwarves themselves who still feel the loss of this place very deeply. So it's a place that I think Baron would very much like to get to. What's great about this campaign and this campaign setting in Belkson is it's not just like a barren wasteland like Siberia. It has so much potential to go any direction, and I'm so excited for the next books.
And only I know where it goes.
This is true. This is true.
That was good. That was interesting. Hopefully nobody turned off the podcast talking about geography. But here's another little wrinkle we'll throw at you, listeners, just to make sure you stop listening altogether. I think it's important, you know, as well as the geography, to talk about the history of how this world happened. Skid, I'm going to give you the same restrictions as Joe, 3 minutes or so, to give the fans a little idea of how Galarian came to be.
Okay. Well, the history of this fictional history of the world goes back something like 16,000 years, when the world was dominated. This part of the world was dominated by an ancient empire called the Thessalonian Empire, which was a human empire and was thoroughly wicked. And they were basically, they were war.
Like Greeks.
Yeah, exactly like modern Greeks. So I don't want to bring race into it, but yeah, they're just like modern Greeks.
Their financial systems are very unstable.
Yeah. And so they're basically at war with the elves until all of a sudden the elves left. And no one at the time knew where they went. And shortly after that, there was an event called Earthfall, where this meteorite, basically this massive meteorite, fell to Earth and destroyed the other major empire in the world, the Aslanti civilization, which you may recognize that name. It was an island nation out in the middle of the ocean. So that destroyed, like, the resulting cataclysm destroyed the Thessalonian Empire and changed the shape of the world. And it caused a kind of a nuclear winter, some like 9,600 years ago from the present. So during that darkness, that time of darkness, there were all these creatures that lived in the Underdark, which Grant mentioned, under the earth, mostly dwarves and orcs. Dwarves lived deeper, and they heard about what had happened up top, and they began what they called the quest for Skye. And they were like, "This, we are going to colonize. We're going to take advantage.
Now that the humans are
now that
dead.
The humans are like decimated, we're going to take our rightful place on the surface." But to do that, they had to get through the orcs, and in the process, they pushed the orcs up onto the surface too. And so there was just a massive battle between dwarves and orcs. And the orcs were able to survive on the surface, too, as much as they liked the darkness, because of the permanent twilight conditions caused by this nuclear winter type situation. So this is where Beltson is where the dwarves and the orcs emerged. And eventually the orcs were able to overcome the dwarves, like Grant was talking about. They took over the Skye Citadel. And there was a warlord named Belkson who, like, expanded the borders. He was the only person who was able to, by sheer force of will, band all these fighting tribes together and, like, make war on the surrounding areas. He was killed. The border shrunk. They've gone backwards and forwards, like, over the centuries. And different tyrants, warlords, have, like, come in and used the orcs for their own purposes. The Whispering Tyrant is one. It was basically kind of like Sauron, and he was defeated by the Shining Crusade, and their dragons have like tried to like take advantage of them. And so now you have the situation where the only thing keeping the orcs in check is the fact that they still fight against each other. If they didn't do that, if they were to unify again, the world political situation is such that they could sweep over all of Galarian if there was just something to unify them.
And Grask Uldeth, the current ruler of Urgir,
yeah,
he is currently attempting to put some form of civility upon them and to kind of band them together. And the fact that this kind of arranged and premeditated plot against Trunau happened, I don't know if it's directly related to that, but it means that they're cooperating a little bit more. We'll learn more about the different clans that were involved in playing this attack, but it's really interesting to think about.
Yeah. Any hints of orc cooperation is terrifying.
I got to be a complete fucking loser because I could have listened to you talk all day. I find that fascinating.
Yep.
I don't know. That's so interesting.
Oh, I could talk about the death of Aridin and Starfall.
Oh,
and
yeah. You know, but it is to me, it's great to know the history. Like, you get to know a little bit about the history, about what you're going, you know, through here. And all of a sudden you see this picture of the orcs that you see a little picture of their history. It makes a little more sense. Why are they here? What are they doing? It's like, oh. Okay, so the dwarves drove them out, and they've been warring ever since, trying to fight for their own place ever since.
Well, if you don't know history, you're doomed to pee on it.
That is what they say.
I think I read that in a fortune cookie. Since your characters are still alive, you're now fourth level.
Yeah.
You did it. You're real characters now. Don't you feel like fourth level is a rite of passage?
Sure is.
Yeah, it's my favorite time in a character's existence, is like between like fourth and eighth level.
Yeah.
You know, they're not so overpowered that you can't relate to them, but they're like powerful enough that they can do a lot of really
cool
stuff.
They're huge badasses compared to regular like common citizens.
Yeah, it's like you graduated from high school.
Right. They're not as annoying as the teenage levels.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Where they break out.
Yeah.
Now, did you, any of you guys, here's the $1 million question, because you're fourth level now. Did any of you take a new class? Did any of you multi-class?
Yep.
What?
You did?
I did.
Really?
Yeah, I took a level in fighter.
Galadriel!
Oh, you motherfucker, because you got that armor.
Because I got the armor and the hammer, and I can't use either of them if I just stay with cleric. So I just wanted to take one level of fighter, just to kind of fortify my combat skills, and then I'll go right back. My plan is to go right back to cleric.
It's called a dip.
The old dip. Yeah. But I mean, it makes sense. Galabras is, you know, obviously he had seen some shit on his way to Trunau, but now he was like in the thick of battle, and he must have realized, like, I gotta learn how to fight.
Well, I think it's more kind of a natural progression of what he's experienced rather than a conscious choice, like on his part.
Right.
He's just been through so much combat that he's kind of learned those
skills. He's developed those skills.
Yeah, yeah.
Any other multiclassers? No?
Okay. I was very close.
Oh, you're not doing it. God damn it, Grant. I was so much shit about that rogue level.
Well,
I wanted to see it.
This is just like when you got a bottle cap for my skill. When you talked about my character. No, I'm just kidding.
Sneak attack.
No, I was thinking about doing sneak attack. It and it would also give us disable device and trap finding to an extent that we wouldn't have. But gunslingers, they're a confusing class, and there's a lot of misinformation about them, but in order for me to become another damage-dealing person that can really contribute to the party in a meaningful way, not that we're min-maxing, we're not doing that, we're avoiding that, and we're doing flavor choices and things that are fun, I really need to progress. But I think at 8th level, if I do it, 7th level, I have an ability called Disarming Shot, which will make characters flat-footed with no save. So if I make a character flat-footed with no save and I have a level of rogue, I can just walk up behind them and then add sneak attack damage, like, super easy. So.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah.
But you want to get to the level where you can add your dex bonus as damage, too, before you do anything.
Fifth level. So I really need to be able to add that as a consistent type of thing.
That makes sense. So after level 5, stay tuned for possibly a rogue level for Baron. Assuming he's alive.
Or monk. Monk is alive.
Monk. Ooh. Monk might be fun. A little hand-to-hand combat.
Kung fu.
Little shoot you, get up close, punch you, and then you're dead.
Yeah. Unarmed strike.
Let's, like we do all the time, and obviously let's keep it brief. I don't care about your, now I have a +4 will save. Talk to me about your new powers at 4th level. Lork, you're a 4th level ranger now. What do you get anything cool?
No.
Nothing.
Yeah, it's not really a big level for rangers. I'm one level away from my second favorite enemy, which I'm super excited about. But you can move on. Though what I realized right now, looking at the numbers tonight, because I got the I have masterwork weapons now and stuff, is I have now, with the weapons that I'm using, I've doubled my attack bonus from when we first started. So when I was first level and I was rolling my d20 to hit guys, it was +4 to hit. So I was hoping to roll like 11 or higher, you know what I mean? And now I'm +8 to hit. So if I go up against those like regular orcs and stuff and roll like a 7 or even an 8, you know, or whatever against on a d20, I'm going to hit melee. So like he's just going to do a lot of melee damage. Oh, and also at 4th level, you get an ability point.
A major thing. You all get that.
Yeah. Right. So, we've been talking a lot about strength and dex and constitution and everything, and you can kind of put something in, put a number in there to start increasing those. And that is a really tough decision because it only comes once every 4 levels. So 4, 8, 12, 16, and then 20. And you never get to 20. No. I've never gotten to 16. So it's sort of like a very rare thing. And I ended up putting it in dex actually for Lork. So I'm not going to max his strength. I'm going to try to get him even better at the bow. I want him to be a really good range character now that Galabras is our frontline fighter.
Right. And ability points, if you're not aware, like you have what, 6 main stats?
Yeah, it's strength, dex, intelligence, wisdom, constitution, charisma.
Right, and you kind of roll for those when you create your character, and those are your numbers. And then every 4 levels, you can add one more point to one of them. It's always a tough choice.
It takes 2 points in any given attribute to actually have a benefit.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So if you had a 17 strength, you definitely made it an 18 because that's when you're going to get your
right exactly. Bonus. And so I had a 6 or a 14 dex, so I put one in it. Now it's 15, so I will absolutely be putting another one in it at 8th level, and then I'll get it to 16, and then my AC will go up, my to hit with my bow will go up, my stealth will go up, my like a lot of things go up at 8th level if you go on that path. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
What about Gormley? Anything new? Some new hexes?
Not a huge level for witches either. The biggest thing is you get a new hex. So Gormley now has prehensile hair.
Yeah!
What?
So basically, For a number of minutes per day, she can grow her hair out. And actually, you can use your facial hair if you're a man, or your eyebrows if you're... or anything, really. Any hair. But yeah, you can grow it up to like
10 leg hair.
You can go up to 10 feet. It can do a number of things. It can manipulate. It can't manipulate weapons, but I think it can hold wands for you. And you can also...
Really?
Touch. You can deliver touch range touch attacks. You can deliver. You can.
Wow.
You can also attack with your hair, and its strength bonus is equal to your intelligence bonus.
Oh.
So my hair is much stronger than I am.
What's the reach on your hair?
10 feet.
Oh, so that's huge.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
Bride of Frankenstein. You can actually reload your gun with a prehensile hair. So I've been thinking about that for a long time. And if you're a tiefling. You can actually wield another weapon with your
tail.
Yeah. And that's reload and do all cool. that stuff. So it's really cool.
Interesting. All right, Corbs. What about Baron? Anything new at level 4 for Gunslinger?
So I guess the most interesting thing is that on this kind of feat treadmill that is being a reg character, you want to start with, point blank range, and then you have options there. You can go for... what's the accuracy one?
Precise shot.
Or you can take something like deadly aim. I took deadly aim instead of that, which is basically power attack for range characters. So I take -2 to hit, +4 damage with less to hit. And that gets more in line with kind of the gunslinger archetype and kind of how I act on the battlefield. So I'll eventually take precise shot, but I feel like he's still so foolhardy and will get himself into daring acts all the time that he would be more likely to focus on having maybe less consistent, but more punishing deadly aim.
Right. And now Gel, the new fighter, what's in Gel's bag of tricks?
Well, I took because you get a bonus. When you take a level of fighter, your first level of fighter, you get a bonus combat feat.
Huge.
So I took rapid reload for the crossbow. So I can reload my crossbow as a swift action rather than a move action, which I figure will be helpful. I can also, I can wear my new armor of Usgroth without penalty. I can wield the hammer of Usgroth without penalty. And for the attribute point, I invested it in strength. Now, if we were min-maxing, I would have invested it in wisdom because I'm at 17 wisdom and another point would put me at 18. It could be a +4 as my bonus instead of +3. The reason I didn't do that is because when we were initially creating the characters, I misunderstood your instructions and I thought we weren't supposed to. You said you can't have an attribute more than 16. I thought you couldn't invest more than 16 points. So I invested 15, and then I put my racial +2 bonus into wisdom, so I had a 17 instead of a 16. But I never said anything because I didn't want to remake my character. So instead of basically cheating, I'm going to fuck myself by giving me a point of strength, which doesn't do anything for me, but I figured it fits more with the character.
Oh, nice. Look at you. Look at that. Look at Skid.
You guys got a lot of treasure, obviously, and I told you all about that, and you sold a lot of it very quickly. I'm sure you guys did a little shopping. Any cool new items?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll just say real quick, Lork is going into book two just like with completely new weaponry. Completely new weaponry, and it isn't better. It's just different, okay. And so I'm kind of excited. It was, some tough choices because I didn't get any magical weapons or armor. So I have the same armor. I don't have any magical weapons, but Screed, which we didn't say on air, we found out later, was wielding a falchion. Shocker, but it was a masterwork cold iron falchion.
Right.
And so cold iron is this like material that is like deep in the earth, like this like extremely hard metal, blah, blah, whatever. And it, we talked about DR a lot and bypassing damage resistance. And there are some monsters out there that can only be hurt by cold iron.
Yeah.
And they're pretty rare and we might never come across one. But if we
it's
do.
It's like silver for werewolves or like.
Right. Whatever. Right. And if we do, I'll have one. So I have one now, which is cool. And I'm back. So I'm off the Great Axe. I'm back to the falchion. It does a little bit less damage, but it has a higher chance to critically hit, which I want to do more crits.
Is that two-handed?
Yeah.
So you have more chance to crit yourself again. Nice.
God damn it.
Fingers crossed.
This is true. And then I also took, we found in that pile, in Let's Cross pile, we found a Masterwork Flail, and I took that because I was like, you know what? I want to have a bludgeoning weapon on me. Because
if
we come across any more skeletons, I want to be able to smash something with the blunt side of a flail.
It's great, too, because you have the quick draw, so you can switch on I can switch
my weapons, which would be cool. And I took my money that I got, and I upgraded from...
started a scholarship in Jacen's name. True Now High.
True Now High.
United. You donated it to the United Half-Orc College
This
Fund.
Is the Jacen wing.
The new weight room for the football team.
I don't know. I don't know if we have time. I'm hoping we do. Maybe for a little flare. I don't know how long it would take. Maybe a couple of days. Basically, he went to Sarah Morninghawk, and he took his old Black Arrow longbow that he had that he dusted off, and he brought out when he first went to the Plague House because he's got a serious attachment to that bow. But he went and took it to her for some serious upgrades, and they sort of reset the wood, and they put some. Strengthening materials in there and did a few different things. So now I have I turned that bow into a Masterwork +3 strength bonus composite longbow.
So, nice.
So with the two attacks, I actually have now bonus to the damage.
Oh,
so yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Gormley, any new items?
Gormley went a little shopping for some scrolls, and then she and Howie had a little powwow. and Howie ate some scroll paste. And now it was just a couple level one spells, but that's really
what spells do you want to save them for when they come up? Or
no, I can tell you, I took enlarge person.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
right.
So now we're gonna have a giant Galabras and a giant Lork
You could double my size when I'm enlarged.
So you go.
So I can be like 25 feet tall.
Oh my shapers.
That'd be great.
That'd be fun.
Your weapon now to 6d6.
Yeah.
I thought about taking reduced person so I could give it to Grant and increase his dex, but I figured that might make him too small to see.
Make him a halfling.
This little 2 foot tall Muppet.
Oh, champ. Hey, fellas.
Bang.
Bang, bang.
You may be green on the outside, but I know you're pink on the inside.
The other one was just an inflict light wounds, because now as a level 2 spell, Gormley has spectral hand. So she can deliver.
You can do range touch attacks with your hand
from far away. That's awesome. So you don't have to be the frontline fighter anymore.
So
a witch.
Yeah, basically, when you're inflicting light wounds, you touch something and suck its life force right out of it. But when you have spectral hand, there's like this ghostly hand that does it from far away, gently touches something and sucks the life right out of it.
Love it.
I could also do it with my hair or Howie.
Nice.
Oh, true. Nice. Yeah. Hey, Howie survived too.
Howie survived.
Howie was never really in danger in all these episodes.
Well, apparently with those critical cards, he was.
We really should have shot him.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Baron, anything, any new shopping items?
Outside of the Belt of Heavy Load, which is kind of gross sounding, I am actually looking at crafting a new gun.
Oh, so you're saving some money. You're saving.
Saving some money, and I'm hoping that I can do a bit of a collabo with my casting friends on making a wondrous gun that could have some magic damage to it as well.
Yes.
I'm looking at, obviously, a submachine gun is beyond our time. What I'm currently looking
with
at...
With a compressor on the front of it.
Try shot.
Black powder Uzi. That'd be fucking cool.
I'm looking at double-barreled pistol. Which is really cool, because you can fire each trigger independently as two separate attacks, or you can fire them both at once at a bit of a penalty.
Oh, that's interesting.
And by the time I get into multiple attack rounds, like being able to reload. Yeah. It's expensive. I'm just shooting my child's college fund out of my gun.
Gel, did you get anything, or you're saving money, right?
No, I didn't really have anything to buy, 'cause I was gifted the wondrous, like Yeah, I was looking at the price for that armor, like I'm putting it in PC Gen. Like, I'm carrying like 150,000 gold pieces of equipment right now based on how powerful these items are. So I was gifted these wondrous like items, this incredible armor and this great hammer. So I'm good.
No shit.
So we could have had those wondrous items this level. But we just have your armor.
Yeah.
It's yeah. So funny,
and
too.
You also have the best magical item in the known world, as far as you know.
Yep. Yeah.
The most, like, item-dependent classes are typically fighters. Am I incorrect in saying that?
Yeah.
I feel like they need, like, the Frostblade Worm +5, but taking it as a cleric is kind of neat, and I'm glad you took that dip.
Speaking of dips, I think it's time to dip into a little bit of book 2.
Yes.
You sons of bitches.
Thank you.
So if you stuck with us, thanks for sticking with us. If you skipped to this.
Skipped ahead to this point. Welcome.
Here's a very little bit of book 2. Oh, this is exciting. Finished reading it, and I'm just like, I just want to tell you guys all that happens. Why don't I just tell you book 2, and then we'll start book 3?
Yeah. Just describe the plot.
And all right. It opens with Lork's death. Fuck! I knew it! He's being paraded throughout the town. So last time, when we wrapped, Halgra came to you guys at the sanctuary with Silvermane. Chagrin and Cursed was there, and we're like, we need to talk to you guys. Obviously, take some time to enjoy your status as heroes, but when you're ready, come to the Ivory Hall to meet with the Council of Defenders. We have a proposition for you. We're taking the fight to them, blah, blah, blah. So you guys walk outside, there's big fanfare, and you guys have a few days to yourself to take care of business, to do your shopping that you've already done off air, obviously, and then you will reconvene, I'm assuming, if you're all up to the task of at least taking a meeting.
take a meeting.
Meeting at the Ivory Hall. So
can we order lunch?
Can we make it a lunch meeting?
they're like, I guess we can get some pizzas. How many pizzas? There's 6 council members. Four of them coming.
No gluten.
Does the scorpion eat? seven large. You guys like toppings?
Throw in a scroll. Throw in a level 0.
Silvermane's a vegetarian.
Yeah, Silvermane. Fucking druids, right?
Yep. We gotta have a salad.
Hagra's she's a celiac. all those years of drinking orc cum.
Jeez. I didn't know that was a side effect.
Yep.
That escalated quickly.
Yep. I had to make this episode a little exciting. Let me ask you this. Is there anything, you say you guys have 2 or 3 days, is there anything your characters need to do business wise before you meet up at the Ivory Hall? Talk to me.
Yeah.
What's Galabras got
to
do?
Galabras is...
off to the gym.
Yeah, well, actually, that is one thing he's going to do, is like, he's going to take a lot of time in the practice yard with Lork and anyone else who will like work out with him, just to like kind of work on his fighting craft. Kind of justify that fighter.
And moment. You know what? I imagine that there's like militia members and stuff now that are like, want to train with Lork and Galabras, like they like kind of hang out and like glom on and like want to like train with us.
Yeah, because
we're like celebrities
we're
in
like
the town.
Local celebs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's chomping at the bit to just kind of hang out with you guys.
Yeah.
If you're at the local pub, if the Killing Grounds is being rebuilt, if you guys are there, Baron hanging out there.
Free drinks for life.
Free drinks for life.
Every time you like look over, someone's staring at you and they just kind of quickly look back. Like you're.
Be cool, man. Be cool.
You're a big deal.
All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Galabras.
The other thing I really want to do, Galabras was really affected a lot by everything he saw. I mean, just thinking about just everything that we encountered in that cave, what an archaeological find that was. It was so Raiders of the Lost Ark. And we did exactly what Indiana Jones was doing. We just looted it and just like dragged everything out without any regard for any like scientific principle. But especially like I said at the end of last episode, finding those items in that chest that seem to have been fated to be delivered to us at this time. So he has gone into the archives of the sanctuary and anywhere that will let him like look at their scrolls. And he's studying up on geography, history, any clue about, any mention about something like this happening. And he's reading up on everything that we've encountered.
Mm. Mm. That's interesting. So he's
smart.
He's building his knowledge base. So
looking
that
at maps,
when they encounter
like just,
shit in the wild.
It's so cool that Troy.
Like, I read
you,
about this.
It's so cool that Troy will give you a +2 bonus on all your knowledge checks now because of that.
It's funny.
I mean, it's more. It's a,
he's really generous.
Is like there that. Another Troy here?
It's a flavor thing to justify my roles. I did like invest skill points in this though.
But sure. You
know. Yeah.
Oh, I liked. I love that.
It and maybe occasionally in the library you look up and see. Lurking in like the stack somewhere, it's like Gormley sitting down, petting Howie, and looking up, and then she disappears
behind a stack. Yeah.
Gormley, wait! She's gone again.
Gormley, where are you staying during these few days before the meeting? Do you go back to your mountain hut to kind of check in on your plants?
You mean the crabgrass I'm growing up in? I think so. Yeah, although I think Gormley has been lurking around the town a little bit. She's uncomfortable with the spotlight, but. The thing I was alluding to earlier is that Gormley has been back to the town before, and Gormley maybe likes her disguises a little bit, and can, if she wants to blend in, is not as can be not as conspicuous as she as people think.
So Gormley's just walking around town with a fake mustache. Hello, good sir.
Gormley, who is Gormley?
Oh, Gormley here. So that
she was the worst. She killed that poor boy all those years ago.
So you're pretty much spending your couple of days here, 2 or 3 days, doing like recon.
I think she also has popped into the library.
Yeah,
maybe to watch Galabras a little bit, maybe to read, maybe a little both.
Right, sliding the archivist some gold to like learn a couple scrolls he might have laying around.
Yeah, you never know.
That makes sense. Baron, what did you do? He just went to pee.
Speak up, man.
You didn't do anything. I guess you said.
Man, silent treatment from Grant.
Well, I don't remember that. -2. Lork.
Passive aggressive.
Lork, I feel like you've gone through a lot, and this is the first time you've had a moment to take it all in.
Yeah, I mean, could you give me, I don't see any need to like role play a bunch of stuff, but can you just give me some idea what happened with like the dead? Of Trunau, like, was there a ceremony or a memorial, or has it not happened yet?
In Trunau, what they do is they take, like, they took Jason's body out and they tied each of his limbs to a horse and
Jesus
then
Christ,
ran them in each direction.
I'm actually trying to be.
I'm
actually trying to, like, play the game.
I'm just role playing. It's Trunau in tradition. You should know that.
Matt, well, I'm sorry I brought it up.
No,
you asked me.
Well, the next day would have been the burial service for Jason.
Okay.
Now, there were various burial services going on around town, and it wasn't like a huge fanfare for your son.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, everyone's burying their dead. Like, those that mother and daughter are burying Carl. The poor toddler.
So it's mostly separate. It isn't like one service that's like covering for
right.
Everybody.
Yeah, they didn't have like a. They're probably gonna have something later in the week in the big amphitheater that you guys were in to like, the only thing I could think of is like what they do on 9/11 every year where they read all the names of the dead, like something like that.
Oh yeah. So they don't just dump all the bodies into a giant slip trench and
no
set it on fire.
Shoot an arrow like Viking funeral. So like, you know, you could bring Jason outside of the walls or near your old house, and they have people helping everyone, you know, townspeople helping. And you had the service for Jason. I don't know if you invited these guys to it, if it was kind of a private thing, but that happened the next day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know what? Then if it's up to me, then I'm going to make it sort of a private thing, and I'm going to go outside the walls. Like, if I can go outside the walls, then I have this image of, Lork kind of like going out there, maybe on horseback or something, like with Jason's body, and like digging, you know, a grave himself in a place where like there are other bodies or whatever, a cemetery that's outside the walls, and just sort of like quietly doing this himself, and you know, there's two main things. It's like he buries them, but, you know, for Lork, it's like, you know, Galabras was talking about like all the treasure that he found and how it made him think about like Desna and the fate of all this kind of stuff. And one of the things that I keep like sticking, like I can't, and you heard it in the last episode, like I couldn't get over it, is like I can't stop thinking about like Screed's rationalization for everything that he did and how violent and really awful Lork's youth was, you know, as a half-orc and even in Trunau, you know, which Screed considered to be like a paradise, you know what I mean? And now
as bad as Lork's experience was, it was still so much better than what he went through.
Exactly. So he's thinking about this and he's like, man, that guy had it like really, really, really bad, right? So there's a god in Galarian and Lork. We talked about this in like episode 7 that Lork had not had like a deity or anything like that. And I really wanted to kind of focus on that. And I think this is kind of a time where like you're starting to feel really alone. He doesn't have a son anymore. Yeah, found religion in a way. And one of the gods that was worshipped a lot, I guess, in the Order of the Black Arrow is his name is Gorum. And he's the god of war and the god of battle and shit like that. And a lot of half-orcs worship him. And I think he saw a lot of that because, you know, the Order of the Black Arrows is a big criminal element. You know, it's a lot of like ruffians and people that if they do have any sort of deity, they're probably praying to some sort of war god. So, like, I guess basically he sort of like tries to talk to this god. Like, he doesn't really expect anything to happen, but he prays, you know. He just prays like for the first time. And he, you know, to ask for Jason's, you know, passage into like the Valhalla, you know, the heaven of warriors kind of thing. And then also like he thinks about Screed, you know, he thinks about like the other half orcs we're going to come across on this adventure and like how many of them are going to be just like these like twisted by their environment sort of beasts that, you know, maybe there's something that he could do to help them or to help bring some sort of civilization to this area. I mean, it's sort of like a goal that's a little bit too big, but he's just older, you know what I mean? Yeah. So he isn't so like, I just want to go out and fight shit. Like he does want to fight for the right cause, but he's also like seeing, you know, all of these like things that life has to offer. So he's just kind of reflecting on that. And he spends like hours and hours and hours and hours out there just completely alone.
I see him like camping out there overnight.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. That's a good idea.
And like silent vigil. To Jason and
silent
having this
vigil
religious
and,
moment.
And you know, like, I don't know what they did with Screed. We don't even need to go into it, but I assume that it was very unceremonious. I assume they just burned his body or, you know, dumped it in the,
it's like Bin Laden. They just dump him out in a helicopter into the ocean.
Exactly. Exactly.
Is that what they did with Bin Laden?
I think so.
Yeah, they dumped him in the ocean.
He had a service, though.
Yeah, they had a service.
Yeah,
they
but like service. It was in secret.
If they had like put him or buried him, he would have become like a mecca of sort for terrorists to visit. So that's why.
Well,
they
that was the idea.
Yeah,
and it's not like you would have said no. We need to bury him the right way. Then they'd start questioning.
Bury him in Arlington with honors.
Yeah, Lork is not. He can't really speak up. You know, he doesn't have that kind of. He's a sergeant. You know what I mean?
Right,
he's a very
right.
low-ranking sort of military person, and so he just sort of reflects on it and he prays to this god about it, sees if he can get any answers. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And then otherwise, he's getting his bow made during that time.
Right.
Baron,
what's going on with you for these couple of days?
So Baron. Baron is taking stock, and he is trying to talk to as many people as he can while he's at the bar about not just information, which is what he'd normally be doing, but in light of him almost having his head bitten off by a lizard and, you know, nearly dying another time, he's honestly just trying to have some sort of normal connection with other people outside of battle. And to some degree, as the night gets on later, which is really late for him as a dwarf and he gets drunk, it might be some sort of escapism. But really, it's just his attempt, as close as he feels with these people. Every time he looks at Galabras, Gormley, or Lork, he sees some of the fucking shit he dealt with. And as much as, you know, the Apocalypse Now, Huey, helicopter pilots rode through with Ride of the Valkyries in the battle, like, I'm sure he has some degree of PTSD surrounding this. So he's just trying to kind of grasp at some moment of normalcy, like he used to have when his parents were around and before all this shit happened. So I think that Baron is very good at recognizing in this harsh world when he has moments of respite to take advantage of them and not freak him out too much. That being said, every moment he has, he is going over the schematics for weapons in his that he carries with him from his family, and he is making sure he has all the materials, everything necessary to begin crafting a new one, and he's like making like a Boy Scout making a gun out of ivory soap. He's whittling them out. He's making sure that what he makes with his hands correlate to the schematic as closely as possible. But I guess overall, he's trying to enjoy himself and be just a normal person for whatever limited time he can.
So for these couple days, I see Baron's kind of sitting at the bar, maybe drowning his condition in the bottle while reading books on gun making.
Just the kind of guy you'd want to avoid at the bar.
He's winning like Dwarf Gun Monthly.
Yeah, he's like sitting in the corner reading Soldier of Fortune. I'm like getting drunker and drunker.
I'm not going to hurt you. It's for the bad guys.
Meanwhile, Galabras is at the gym wailing on his pecs.
Bigger, faster, stronger. Ugh.
Lork is out in the woods just praying, and just Gormley's being creepy at the library. That's what's happening.
Just and all around town.
No, she is like Ally Sheedy in the Breakfast Club.
It always comes back to that. With a fake mustache, too, by the way.
You'll never guess who I am.
And, after a few days pass, you guys make your way to the Ivory Hall. And as you do, there's a smell of death in the air, and you realize this is the day they're burning the rest of the orc bodies. And as you walk by, each of you on your way to the Ivory Hall, you can see what's left of Screed's body being burnt, because you notice a lock of blonde hair on the pile.
He's just one of the pile.
Just crisps up. Yeah. So even in death, he never got to stand out amongst the crowd. And it's tough, you know? I mean, this guy was not a good guy. He was a chaotic, evil dude, but nature versus nurture.
Well, he wasn't orc.
He wasn't orc.
Half orc.
Half.
Yeah, slow your roll, Skid.
Now, you guys know that the Ivory Hall, and Baron, even though you're newer to town, you would know that the Ivory Hall is the seat of power in Trunau. Anybody have knowledge history?
Yes.
Yes.
Give me a knowledge history roll.
24.
Oh, that'll do. Galabras, maybe in your reading, in your copious amounts of reading over these days, you would know that back in the day, the Ivory Hall was like festooned with the skulls of the most ferocious orc champions and chieftains that were killed in Trunau's first siege. And their eye sockets were like a mute testimony to both the constant threat under which Trunau exists and to the Trunauans' unwavering commitment to surviving these orc raids. But later generations of counselors found the display to be too grisly, too barbaric, and actually much too similar to the way orcs would do business, like hanging the heads on stakes outside their forts. Yeah. So they were like, let's get rid of these bones. Like,
are we no better than the orc?
Exactly. I mean, that's what they were saying. Like, we can't, I get it. And this might be like a little boost to the morale of the people, but we're not.
But
we're
it's not
like
cool,
them.
You guys. Yeah. It's not cool.
And imagine the half orcs walking around town like, that's might be my dad. today the hall gets its name because of its brilliant white walls when you go inside, and it's the home of Chief Defender Halgra. And she actually puts the manor to good use. Lork, you would know this, and this is kind of a known thing around town. She lets her grown children house their own families in various rooms throughout the Ivory Tower. So it's because, of Halgra back in the day, she was a bit of an adventurer, and she was a bit of a loose woman who had many relationships with half-orcs and humans alike, and so she's got all these kids, and so she just kind of lets them live in the ivory hall. But the only room that's off-limits to all of these, her rough-and-tumble clan, is the meeting room, which is where you guys are supposed to be heading. So you guys get there, and there's two guards outside of the hall. They obviously let you in. Oh, my God, it's Lorik. It's Glavis's parent. It's Gormley. Holy shit. Should we ask for a selfie? No. Hello, gentlemen. Come on. So you go through the first set of double doors, and you just see little, like, half-orcs running around and humans.
Kids.
All different skin colors and shapes and sizes running around. But then you are led off.
Paradise.
You're led off to a...
It's like a Benetton commercial.
Another room that has just beautiful, ornate, white doors. And there are more guards standing outside those doors. And they see you guys and obviously allow you entrance into the room. And when you go in, the whole back wall is just an open window that has... the Ivory Hall, by the way, is right on the southeastern portion of town. So the Ramble House is on the southwest corner. This is tucked away into the southeast corner. So this back window opens up with these commanding views of the countryside. Beyond
over the wall?
Yeah, over the wall. Okay. True now.
Beautiful.
And it's gorgeous, and she uses this mainly to host her war councils, entertain visitors that like come to do trade in Trunau, emissaries from other areas from far away from Trunau, or even pathfinders who come to Trunau, doing expeditions into Belkson. So you guys walk in, and there is a long marble table. A beautiful marble table that stretches all the way to the end of the room. And you can see Halgra of the Blackened Blades, Chief Defender Halgra of the Blackened Blades, played by Melissa McCarthy, sitting at the far end of the room. And she says, welcome. Please have a seat. And there are four seats at the opposite end of the table around a rounded portion where the table rounds out for you guys to sit. And then on either side of the table are a number of people. To Halgra's left is patrol leader Jigrin Grath, your old buddy Jigrin, Lork's boss. Kirst is standing...
Paul Giamatti.
Played by Paul Giamatti.
And is a known racist.
Known racist. But you guys had a surprisingly good encounter with him when you did have to tell him what was going on.
Surprisingly good.
Your fireside chat.
And he was super cool after we saved the town.
Yeah. So maybe he's worth giving a second chance.
Maybe he's not a dick.
Standing behind him, kind of not at the table, so against the wall, you see Kirst. He's not part of the council, but he's been invited in. And he's played by that guy from Big Bang Theory, Jim something.
Jim Parsons.
Yeah, Jim Parsons. Good for him. To the
we needed to give him another role,
really, really.
To Halgra's,
he's already got all that Microsoft money.
To
also multiple Emmys, but
that's true.
To Halgra's right is High Priestess Tyari Varvatos.
Oh, Tyari!
Hey. I don't think I ever cast her.
You never did cast her.
There she is, and she's
Senorita Varvatos.
Is she? I would like to suggest Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Okay, yeah, she could use the...
But like in that Sean Connery movie...
She just got like way more beautiful.
No. Like in the movie where she has those yarn pieces out to simulate the lasers where they're heisting and her butt...
Yeah, yeah. With Sean Connery.
Entrapment.
Yeah. Entrapment.
Entrapment. Good call.
Can I make a diplomacy check to have sex with her?
Hold your act.
Come on, man. It's been a lifelong dream.
She's a high priestess.
He's like from the Jersey Shore now. He's been doing gym tan laundry.
Yeah, I look really good. This is the best Galabras has ever looked
like. Galabras sees Tyari and just starts now or like, never. Flexes in his shirt.
Yeah. His confidence is through the roof now.
Hello.
I took a level in fighter.
Hello, Tyari.
There are a couple other people in the room. You see Sarah Morninghawk and her wife, Agreet Steganstar, and they look like they're doing pretty well. Sarah doesn't have any bandages on her. She looks like she bounced back pretty quickly. Must be her orc ferocity.
Is Ygritte still a dwarf? Because that's terrible.
Ygritte is a dwarf.
No, she's a... Yes. Oh, yes, right.
She is.
Yep. Little Ygritte is standing there, who owns the magic shop. You also see a woman that you haven't met yet. You would know if you're from here. It is counselor and banker Lessie Crumkin. She is a female cleric of Abadar, but not the douchebag
D-bag
that almost hung Brynja.
Michael Madsen.
Right, played by Michael Madsen. This is
who's she played by?
A rather attractive woman. She...
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. But from
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
And
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
And Tyari Varvatos is played by Entrapment Catherine Zeta-Jones. And Leslie Crumkin is played by High Fidelity Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Oh, whoa. Wow. Way hotter. So,
very different hairstyles.
Just to give you a clear picture of the room.
One of them has a Welsh accent. The other one has an American accent.
That's true.
Yeah.
I love Sigurd.
There is one other man standing there.
Charlie.
And then, Charlie. Excuse me, there's behind Halgra, you see, standing is Silvermane.
Oh, this is the dude I want to talk to.
Played by
Donald Sutherland.
Yeah. An elf, by the way, who was the keeper of the Hope Spring.
Yeah.
He's standing there beside her. And there's one other man at the table that Lork, you've seen around, you would know. And the others of you would not know. Maybe Galabras, you've heard of him. But Gormley, you look at this man, and he looks so friggin' familiar, you can't place him. Roll a perception check.
18.
Halgra says, I'm sure you know everyone here. This is Sarah and her wife, Agreet. And, of course, you know High Priestess Tyari Varvatos. Silvermane is... right here, and Patrol Leader Jagran Grath and Kirst is with us as well. This is Leslie Crumkin. You may recognize her from High Fidelity. And
what's John Cusack like?
And then this here is our Master of Stores, Mr. Kessin Plum. And right when she says that name, Gormley realizes... it's the young man she was in love with.
What?
Who she hasn't seen in decades.
Holy motherfucking.
He's on the council?
Whoa. He's like the master of coin.
Because he was a rich fuck.
And he's played by Aidan Gillen, who's Peter Baelish. From Game of Thrones.
Love that guy.
But you know what? It's no big deal because Gormley's been doing great on her own.
And yeah, she has.
Before you even have a moment to kind of take this all in, you notice that there's one more empty chair, and Hagrid says, we'll get started once our last council member is here. The doors burst open right as she says that. And it's Tom Exposition.
Yeah!
Hey, fellas, bet you have a lot of questions. I'll answer them all next week.
Tom, I'm so happy to see you.
Tom, right
fuck
now.
You.
Wait, no,
fuck
Tom,
you.
Right now.
Tom, right now. Come on, Tom. Tom, Tom.
Tom, 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 Tom